But explicit materialism is not keeping up with the world. I rarely discover it today outside the columns of French provincial journals, for the clarity of materialism appeals to the French temper, in a couple of obscure English weeklies, and in faded manuals a generation old treasured by elderly men. The materialist has been left behind, and, for my part, I don't mind lingering in the rear of the column and making friends with the footsore straggler. The materialist will not recover strength in our own day. If I may be allowed to dogmatize enormously, I will tell you why. He will not do so because the devil has, for the moment, no further use for him. The devil used the materialist, though the materialist had no use for the devil for his own ends, between the middle of the 18th and the last third of the 19th centuries. Now the devil has impatiently ordered the materialist to get out of the way, and, like youth, the devil will be served. He has made our generation to grant to deal with the materialist. Spiritual forces have been awakened in us. We must talk about the will to peace, the will to power. The will to this and that and the other, a horrible piece of bad English. We want to live our full life and have discovered oddly enough that you cannot do that without a living principle, that is, without a soul. So one may take it that the materialist is today, after the Bible Christian, the last and weakest of the survivals, and that is why I have put him second on the list. He will not have wholly disappeared before my death, I hope, though I fear he will, for when he has I shall feel very lonely. There was a time, yes, up to the end of the 80s, when he was a constant companion, and one could be certain of meeting him pretty well anywhere. The world will be emptier without him, but he is on his last legs. I beg that no one will mix him up with his more powerful, but nastier, modern brethren, who are so angry at having the relationship mentioned. The pantheist especially abhors him, but he is better than them all. Should he die in my own time, which is likely enough, I will follow piously at his funeral, which is more than I will do for any of the others. But when he dies, his works will live after him, and in due time he will return. He is irrepressible. He lurks in the stuff of mankind. 3. The wealth and power argument. At this point we pass a dividing line between the survivals that are patently exhausted and those which, though defeated, are still in activity and still play a considerable part in the modern offensive against the faith. The Bible Christian is nearly a fossil. The avowed materialist is a rare specimen dating from long ago. But the historical argument against Catholicism, the spirit of scientific negation, and this wealth and power contention which we are about to examine, are of great remaining weight, though declining. They form part, still, of active discussion, and they still affect the issue. The wealth and power argument is briefly as follows. The Catholic Church is false because nations of Catholic culture have declined steadily in temporal wealth and power as compared with the nations of an anti-Catholic culture, which, in this particular instance, means the Protestant culture. The first remark we make upon hearing such an argument is that, supposing it to be true, it suffers from two defects in application. It is irrelevant, b. it does not establish a chain of cause and effect. The second remark we make is that it is not true. We stand, when confronted by this wealth and power argument, much as a man might stand when confronted by the argument that the broad streets and the careful planning of such a town as Washington, D.C., was misuse of energy, because it has been found in practice that a town with narrow and confused streets like Cairo, allowed to grow haphazard, had the higher birth rate. The argument would be irrelevant because the building of a town with foresight, and giving it broad streets, is not intended to affect the birth rate, but ease of traffic and other conveniences of living, and there is no attempt at producing a chain of cause and effect between a high birth rate and narrow streets. Moreover, it is not true. At one period or in one country the one sort of town has the higher birth rate, in another place or time, the other sort. Nevertheless, the argument made a very strong appeal and powerfully affected men's ain't minds in all countries till quite recent years. Even today it has considerable strength. Below a certain level of instruction it is almost universal in countries of Protestant culture, and though, in nations of Catholic culture, modern evidence has become too strong for it, there are pockets of isolated, old-fashioned thought where it has lost little of its original value. These belated people, it is true, are rather to be found among those who have neither traveled nor read much and who are thinking in terms of old tags about enlightenment and progress, particularly such tags as freedom of the press, education of the masses, and all the rest of it. In connection with its irrelevancy, there is needed a paradox which not all those engaged on the Catholic side of the controversy have heeded. It is that such example is effective, where a clear case of superiority in political and economic power can be established. The idea that there is a corresponding superiority in the philosophy or religion of those enjoying such power will be inevitably entertained by men. It will be entertained for the wrong reasons, from confusion of thought and false ideals, but, and this is the important point, it will also be entertained for reasons which have a real intellectual and moral value. As to the wrong reasons, the object of a religion or a philosophy is not to make men wealthy or powerful, but to make them, in the last issue, happy, that is, to fulfill their being. If such happiness is to be found by an immortal race, it must not be sought in a transitory and mortal, but in a final and immortal happiness. It is an absurd philosophy which makes one do that which pleases for an hour but makes him miserable for the rest of his life. And those who accept the doctrine of immortality cannot appeal to temporal effects as the aim of a true religion. But there is irrelevancy in the argument even for that increasing number who reject the ancient doctrine of immortality. Which irrelevancy is that wealth and political power do not of themselves produce even mortal happiness. Even if the wealth and power be well distributed throughout a community, its members will not be happy unless they are inwardly so. And obviously, where the distribution is bad, where the few have a vast superfluity and the many are consumed by anxiety or want, or where a few controllers can exercise their will over the many, society has failed, even though its total wealth and power be increased. What then is the false reason which, in spite of such obvious truths, impels men to accept the argument? It is that all men have as individuals an appetite for wealth and for the power it brings, and the confusion between this and final good is the commonest of errors. Indeed, to our race, save when it is trained in the Catholic philosophy, wealth and power appear as being almost self-evidently the objects of life. Saint Thomas has discussed that illusion in his famous question, whether money be the main good? And all men, not caring to pursue the reasoning to its conclusion, answer yes. Even where the faith is preserved, men pursue wealth and power inordinately. Where the faith is lost, they pursue nothing else. Now the individual, being thus filled with the pursuit of wealth and the power it brings, projects himself into the community and sees in its increasing total riches a sort of greater individual doing what he himself would wish to do. In that pursuit he impoverishes himself and most others to the advantage of a small number, but the effect is lost upon him and the illusion of general prosperity. Thus our industrial towns in the modern world boast their good fortune, though the bulk of their inhabitants are needy or half enslaved. Such are the false reasons which impel men to accept the argument when, in fact, greater total wealth and power are present in a Protestant than in a Catholic society. But are the reasons for accepting it which have a real intellectual and moral value? There are, and that is the point I would particularly emphasize, because it is commonly forgotten. We all live by economic effort and we all rejoice in the strength of our country. Virtue and necessity combine to make us do so. We rightly blame habits of sloth or a mood of indifference to the greatness of the state. When we say, for instance, that drunkenness ruins the power of production in a man, or corruption among its politicians the political power in a nation, we are putting things on a high and good ground, though not on the highest. The highest ground on which to condemn drunkenness in the workers and corruption in public men is that each is morally evil. But to say that their effects impoverish and weaken is to put their condemnation on sufficient grounds. If men hold a moral code which permits such things, we rightly judge, by the outward effects of that code, poverty and national failure, that their code is false. If another code produces sobriety and hard word and a strict discipline over politicians, forbidding their taking bribes or submitting to blackmail, then, other things being equal, we rightly conclude that this second code is the better. It is this common sense consideration that is of such weight in the argument. If, wherever Catholicism ruled the minds of men and in proportion to its influence we found wanting misery due to sloth and other bad habits and a breakdown in the power of the state, if wherever Catholicism was expelled, and in proportion to its absence, we found cheerful, productive, willing industry and a high standard maintained in the public service, especially in its chiefs. If in the first we found external ugliness, vile and insufficient food and drink, dirt and misery, while in the second we found beauty in building, good cooking, cleanliness and merriment, then nothing could prevent men from deciding for the second against the first. The practical argument would be too strong for the theoretical. No presentation of truth in the abstract could avail against the visible, tangible thing present to people's eyes and hands. Here things go well and better, though they go badly and worse, the conclusion is obvious. Now that is precisely the ground on which the wealth and power argument stood in its moment of chief effect, which was the mid-19th century. There, though it had been badly battered, it stands for many even today. That argument was particularly effective in England during the same mid-19th century, and still remained very effective there to its close. This was a period when Protestant England was rapidly increasing in wealth, numbers, and extent of dominion, and when the nations of Catholic culture suffered either from decline in wealth in one case, or decline in population in another, or internal convulsions from which England was singularly free. Further, the example immediately to hand, that of Ireland, powerfully affected the minds of Englishmen. They saw there a nation of Catholic culture rapidly declining in wealth and numbers, compared with their own. They did not consider their own contribution to this result. They thought it an example of cosmic process, of divine judgment. It was customary at the same time to press the contrast with Spain in particular. In all our popular histories, a continuous curve of advance was shown from the England of the 16th century challenging the might of Spain and defeating it in battle, to the present day. We were shown Protestant England advancing unlimitedly and the all-powerful Catholic champion of the 16th century falling from lower to lower level for 300 years, losing its dominion and wealth, lagging further and further and further behind in the advance of material science, failing in population and sinking to what an English prime minister, the most capable man of his generation, called a dying nation. At the same time, in the more apparently prosperous nations of Catholic culture, it was the anti-Catholic forces which were a light to material prosperity and political power. The revival of France after 1871 was slow until, in 1876, an anti-Catholic group captured the machine and maintained its power. It transformed public education, successfully copied alien institutions, increased the apparent wealth of the nation, or at any rate presided over its rising accumulation of wealth. The universities achieved their new triumphs under direction vigorously opposed to Catholicism, and one law after another broke the power of the church. Italy, from a number of petty states, grew to be a kingdom united and claiming to some standing as a European power. It did so under influences which were at war with the Church. The papacy was attacked, despoiled of its states and their capital, and thrust down a slope by which it seemingly must rapidly fall to insignificance. A movement parallel to that in France permeated the whole country. Its public education, its press, its literature took on the new tone, and with it a new Italy arose before men's eyes. All this confirmed the English certitude that Catholicism was identical with decay, and there was added a domestic experience which strengthened the conviction. A vivid interlude of Catholic reaction on a small scale, but startling in intensity, illuminated and alarmed that generation. It secured a small but brilliant band of converts and roused in its votaries extravagant hopes for the future, but it failed. Its chief result was to modify the established Protestant Church. And it was soon perceived that the individual converted Catholicism in England suffered in its pocket and in his social chances of every kind. He was and continues to be an object lesson in the theory of Protestant supremacy. If the convert belonged to a great commercial or financial house, he ceased to affect its fortunes. He was not seen at the head of any new enterprise. He failed to establish a press. As a writer, his history or fiction was neglected. As a thinker, he might create, as did Newman, a strong effect for a moment, but a passing one. Nor did the numerical proportion of converts to the rest of the nation increase. The argument, thus effective here in England, grew to be equally effective elsewhere. This was the period in which Protestant Prussia rose to the height of its power. She defeated Catholic France and Catholic Austria. She confirmed her grip over the Poles and dominated the Catholic minority of her new Reich. It was the period in which the United States, after passing successfully through a very grave crisis, proceeded to a rapid increase in material goods, population, and, at the end, international strength. In general, also the whole Protestant culture was advancing continuously in industrial development. A long lifetime and more was filled with this impression of contrast to the disadvantage of Catholicism, and on that account, even today, when it is failing, the survival of this wealth and power argument against Catholicism demands our close attention. Now let us consider what truth there lay in this attitude, and why, in spite of that element of truth, it was fundamentally false, and today is growing less and less tenable. In the first place, we must heavily discount the Protestant culture as an own view of itself. All human groups tend to this false perspective, and so do all individuals. A man is the chief object in his own landscape. His troubles or successes are invariably less in the scheme of society than they appear to him to be. But the Protestant culture greatly exaggerates this natural tendency. From a morbid self-sufficiency which is to be discovered in all its forms of expression, this proceeds in part from the chosen race tradition which was originally rooted in Bible worship, but more from a general ethical principle. It is thought a duty, and coincident with patriotism, to cherish a conception of superiority, superiority of own's and own national unit over the rest, and superiority of own's and culture in general over an opposing culture. You find that running through all current speech. In the North, Hollanders is contempt for those south of the dike, in Berlin Saint contempt for Vienna, in the American word doggo, and those innumerable descriptions of our own institutions and productions which end up with a sort of doxology best in the world. Next, we must remark that this spirit not only neglects what is excellent in others but forgets elements of wealth and power in which its own people do not excel. For instance, urban government in the Reich is, or was, the most orderly and economic in Europe, but the urban architecture there was the least attractive. The man of this culture will note the less cleanly streets of a rival people rather than their greater beauty. If his food is uneatable, that is an insignificant point, whereas if his postal service is good, it becomes a test of civilization. If his trains are punctual and swift and the track better laid than elsewhere, these are proofs of leadership. That the cost of transport is excessive becomes a minor part. If his country leads in the amount of a particular product, then mass is the test. But if it leads in excellence, then excellence is the test and mass is a secondary consideration. To all this we must add the effect of history. History may be so written that every advance or success is a climax, every reverse an interlude, and history so written is worse than none. Yet Protestant history has been so written for generations. An incident petty in the future of Europe becomes capital because it is national. Everything leading up to the existing state of affairs is a piece of good fortune. It was a piece of good fortune that the monarchy broke down, that cabinet government arose, that the industrial towns increased. For long it was a piece of good fortune that the population was rising rapidly. Now it is a piece of good fortune that the birth rate is falling as rapidly. The most striking example of this spirit is found in the neglect of the basis of all society, the land. The loss of a peasantry and irreplaceable loss in the strength of a nation is passed over as a minor detail. The immense agricultural wealth of the Catholic culture is left aside, and nation saint volume of foreign trade and the intensity of its industrialism are made the tests of economic success. Another consideration of the first importance in judging the wealth and power argument is the secular fluctuations in these. It is not true that there has been a steady rise in the Protestant culture, a steady fall in the Catholic. The very buildings of the past are there to teach the least instructed man that lesson of fluctuation. History leaves no doubt on it. The 17th century and a generation more was a period of material Catholic ascendancy, led by the French monarchy. The phase on which the wealth and power argument was based was a later phase, doubtfully apparent in the later 18th century, and only really manifest after the Revolutionary Wars. We may recall in this connection the rise and fall of material wealth and power over great spaces of time, the old Mohammedan thesis. Mohammedanism at the height of its power claimed its superiority in the arts and in military strength to be the proof of its philosophic truth. Would it apply that test to the last 200 years? There is no permanence in these things. The argument has, then, been advanced on a false basis, but it contains an element of truth which we must admit. In the 19th century, the Protestant culture did, increasingly, dominate its rival. It followed a rising curve whose summit was reached and passed as the century ended. The causes were multiple: the French Revolution with its unexpected effect in creating modern Prussia and its destruction of the French fleet, the great anti-clerical religious quarrel which long paralyzed Italy, still heavily handicaps the French and ran through all Catholic Europe with a violence only now diminishing, the successful exploitation of special natural resources chiefly of coal outside the Catholic culture, the exhaustion due to civil disturbance and internal wars within it. But whatever its causes, and there were many more, the phenomenon was there. On it all that was solid in the argument turned. But, I repeat, these phases of material success are not permanent, and that is why the argument has no final value. Today, before our eyes and beyond question, the tide in Europe has turned. Consider in support of that conclusion the more obvious things. There are the new nationalities Poland and Ireland, the remarkable rise of Italy, which at last men begin to appreciate, the slow but regular advance of Spain. There is the rapid and manifest increase for what it is worth in mechanical science throughout the Catholic culture. There is the profound change in strategic conditions. Most important of all, there is the appearance of the Catholic tradition as the one safeguard against the dissolution of our society. That society will pass through many strains before it is reconsolidated. Wherever the industrial system has reached its second generation, it is threatened by two mortal perils. The first is the demand by an organized proletariat for sustenance without relation to the product of its labor, a demand which threatens the very existence of profit, on the necessary presumption of which capitalism reposes. The second, and immediately graver danger, is that of a revolt for the confiscation of the means of production. Against these two forms of menace it is the Catholic culture to which men confusedly turn. Against the first, the Catholic culture is a defense by its tradition of cooperative labor, the resurrection of the peasant, and the doctrine of private property. Against the second, by its moral effect in a code which wars to the death against communism. The presence of Poland as a bastion against the revolution directed from Moscow is more than a symbol. Underlying all the great change is a change in the mind. To one who watches Europe as a whole, the chief spiritual phenomenon of these years is the return of Catholic philosophy, directly, in the intellectual fashion of the schools, but, as yet, far more strongly in the indirect effects which you may see everywhere in literature and speech and action. It is witnessed to by the very contrast between itself and the extravagant paganism around it. The first has the note of endurance, the second of a fever flaming to death. For the historical argument, next among the more important survivals is the historical argument. Like the others, it has definitely crossed the borderline between active life and decay, but has more vigor left in it than remains to the wealth and power argument with which I have just dealt. First, let us define it. I mean by the historical attack upon the Catholic Church, not the common thesis that history shows her to be but a man-made thing, with divinities that are illusions, like all divinities, that belongs rather to my next section on scientific negation, but rather the attempted proofs from history that the claims of the Catholic Church to certain historic positions are invalid. For example, the faith affirms that in the sacrament of her altars is the full humanity and divinity of Jesus Christ really present. I am not here concerned with the idea that this is but one more example of an illusion, such as many parallel heathen customs can show, that I leave to another discussion, but rather the argument that we can prove this doctrine to be a late invention of hers, and that her affirmation of its original revelation to her by her founder can be disproved by historical research. For centuries it is maintained no such doctrine was held. Or again, the faith affirms a trinity, of Father, Son and Holy Ghost, as a doctrine coeval with herself. The historical attack professes to prove, not that the doctrine is false, but that it formed no part of the original doctrine. Again, the Church affirms the supremacy of Peter. The historical attack would make this a later accretion. She affirms the infallibility of the patron see. The historical attack would attempt to prove that no such conception was possible before the later Middle Ages. That is what I mean here by the historical attack on the Catholic Church. To note the weakening, in our own time, of this, which was for so long a main attack, is of very high interest. It is, perhaps, The most arresting change of all that has happened in the things of the mind during the last 50 years, whatever form of attack Catholicism suffered during nearly 400 years, whatever other weapons might be used against it, from the scholars of the Renaissance to our own day, it was taken for granted that, in historical argument, at least, the Church would stand on the defensive, and, until our own day, upon the defensive she did generally stand. I am not saying that the defensive was not successful, it often was, as a defensive often is in any other form of conflict, but still, it was a defensive. Even before the outbreak of chaos in the 16th century, before that is, the original confusion too much associated with the name of Martin Luther, there had been, for a lifetime, attacks upon tradition which derived all their weight from the historical argument, and when actual revolt broke out, after 1517, reliance upon history as a sure method of victory against the faith became universal. There were two reasons for this which are often confused, and which should be kept distinct. The first is the fact that a number of unhistorical traditions and affirmations had grown up as accretions to Catholic practice in the course of the Dark and Middle Ages. There were masses of doubtful relics, masses of legend which had come to pass for fact, and all the rest of it. None of these affected the theory of the Catholic Church, but in practice an attack upon them was more valuable for weakening the authority of true religion. The mind is powerfully affected by any association of ideas. Also, men easily fail to distinguish between the essential and the accessory. Therefore, when any part of the practice of a man or an institution can be successfully attacked, the whole of their claims and character may, with good fortune, be destroyed in the public mind. The value of playing upon such confusion has not been lost upon historical pamphleteers who have made it their lives and work to attack the faith. For instance, Macaulay. To reconcile his reader to his wildly unhistorical thesis that the English crown was by lawful right at the disposal of a few rich men, he enlarges on the horrid fact that James II indulged in mistresses. It is about as valuable an argument as it would be to plead the ugliness of a railway carriage in defense of not having paid alms and fare, but it went down and did the work Macaulay intended it to do. Now, the reformers were the more intelligent of them well aware that every time you disproved a myth connected with religion you introduced in the public mind a doubt upon the value of the whole religious edifice. For instance, if you exposed the donation of Constantine, and showed that the document was not of the date it was thought to be and contained a mass of unhistorical matter mixed up with what are quite certain historical facts, you shook the authority of the papacy, and this, although the authority of the papacy had existed for centuries before any appeal was made to the donation of Constantine. Historical attacks of this kind offered a boundless field for the exercise of ingenuity and industry, because popular piety, distortion of tradition, misreading, credulity and forgetfulness had, in the course of so many centuries, produced a thick growth of unfounded things, and men's ain't very affection for them made their destruction the more effective. There was unlimited opportunity for exposing doubtful follies or ridiculous affirmation in practice, and therefore, by an association of ideas, weakening fundamental doctrine. Thus, there could not be two complete sets of relics of Saint Mary Magdalene, one in the south of France and one at Vézelay, yet both were worshipped. Both could therefore be ridiculed. Acts of martyrdom containing gross anachronisms were used to throw doubt upon the very existence of the martyr, or on the plain historical fact of his having suffered death for the faith. They could also be used to weaken all devotion to such heroism and to make men forget or despise the courage which had secured us in our Christian heritage. It was not difficult to show that Saint Denis, the apostle of Northern Gaul, and bishop of Paris, was not, as had been childishly imagined, the same of Dionysius, the Areopagite, but of less antiquity. It was still easier to show that there was no contemporary evidence for his carrying his head under his arm. It was a simple matter to show to the anger of the peasants of Karnak that Saint Cornelius, in spite of his name, had no special association with horned beasts. This, then, was the first opportunity for using the historical method against the Catholic Church, to wit, that there was, when the attack opened, a great mass of legendary accretion which the historical method could destroy, and by so doing, weaken the main structure as well. But the second opportunity, more subtle and far less ingenuous, was perhaps of still greater effect. It was that of denouncing the necessary growth of the living church by referring every practice to the test of primitive forms where these were discoverable and, where they were not discoverable, of saying they had never existed. It consisted in pointing out to the mass of everyday people, who had never thought about these things, that something with which they were familiar in doctrine or practice, had not existed as a practice before such and such a date, or had not been defined as a doctrine before such and such a date. This way of directing an historical attack upon the Church was based upon that most useful of all fraudulent practices and controversy, the taking for granted of a first principle without putting it forward in so many words, the inoculating of the mind of onesent victim with a supposed truth which he thinks must be accepted because it is not even argued, but simply postulated. In this case the first principle assumed was that anything added to an original practice, or any further and more exact definition of an original doctrine, was necessarily a corruption. This way of using historical argument against Catholicism had, as in the case of the first method, boundless opportunity. The institution that the reformers were attacking had existed for 1,500 years, and had, during all that period, lived an intense and flourishing life full of fruit and development. But the everyday man who heard the argument for the first time, used to the practice of his own time, might easily be shocked at hearing that such a practice was traceable to an origin not very remote, or at any rate, long after apostolic times. Almost anything could be treated as an innovation. This second method was easier to meet logically than the first, but harder to meet in social practice. It has never had any weight with instructed men, but it is fine sauce for fools, and a snare to the humble. Tell a man, for instance, that the host was not elevated before the 11th century, that the celibacy of the clergy was in violent debate during the 10th, and that in practice it was not universal. Tell him that appointment to bishopric and abbacy had virtually been in lay hands long before the outbreak of the quarrel of investitures, that genuflection and lights and bells are of such and such dates in each case. The plain man who is so used to the elevation, celibacy, clerical appointment, etc., that he could imagine no other condition, would be shocked. He would say to himself, "This, which I had believed to be the very material of my religion, I thought to be also as much a fixed part of it in the earliest times as it is today. Now that I have been shown this was not the case, I find all my religion untrustworthy." I say that until our own time, the strength of the historical attack upon the Church held the field. It affected the unlearned far more than the learned. It never triumphed, that is, it never destroyed the thing which it attacked, because its method was false. But it was of prodigious effect. There are three reasons why the historical argument against Catholicism has recently lost so much of its force. The first is this: persistent reiteration has at last persuaded our opponents that in proving a custom not primitive or a full definition of doctrine to be late in date, they are wasting their time. Many continue so to waste it, but the more serious anti-Catholic historians will no longer engage themselves in beating the air. So long as they thought that the method was damaging, they continued. When at last they discovered that Catholic historians welcomed the growth of custom and definition in the Church, that the Church is a living organism in which such development is part and parcel of being, they turned to other weapons. The second is that, on our side, there has been a disuse of a bad habit, that of walking into the snare of the enemy. It was natural for so very ancient and rooted a thing as the Church to maintain as much as might be of any tradition. It was inevitable that the institution bound up with myriads of the populace, thousands of localities and scores of societies, should find each defending its peculiar associations. Such and such a shrine will cling to its legendary as to its true history, such and such a population to its repeated tales. Moreover, in view of the damage done to the whole structure in the past by assault upon its accretions, loyal men were rightly chary of aiding such assault by acquiescence in the jeers of enemies. But a vigorously critical spirit arising within the Church has grown continually and has by this time done invaluable service. It has even sometimes exceeded its task, but at any rate it has cleared us of reproach. The third reason is allied to this. The same critical spirit on the Catholic side has at last successfully turned its own weapons against those who first originated the historical attack and so long continued it. There was a vast amount of accurate criticism on the Catholic side, begun in the late 16th century, and continued into the early 19th. But this industry was undertaken either without any polemic views, or only in answer to an attack already delivered. In other words, it was filled with the spirit of the defensive. We did not take the initiative. It is astonishing how late the idea first seems to have occurred, within the body of those who revere tradition, that a still more exact examination of evidence might prove in their favor. It was not, one may say, until the 19th century, and hardly in full vigor before the last third of the 19th century, that this new spirit appeared. But, once it had appeared, the opportunities which lay before proved so unexpectedly numerous that great numbers were attracted to the new interest. A school in defense of tradition was formed, rapidly increased, and rapidly gained weight. It is not a united school, it is formed of various sections often at issue one with another in their philosophy, but the general trend of the stream is clearly apparent, and it is running most vigorously. There are many masters of this new historical work who have no particular sympathy with Catholicism. Not a few individuals engaged in it have even an active dislike of Catholicism. Yet, the new and more thorough examination of the past is making everywhere for the Catholic traditional standpoint, and with every year that passes, the position gets stronger. I would give one example out of a thousand that already mentioned of the donation of Constantine. From the end of the Dark Ages, somewhere in the 9th century, this document was known and used in the West and accepted as genuine. About a century and a half after it had first appeared in the West, or at least, after the date when we of today can first trace it in the West, it began to be used as a support for the papal claims. The donation purports to be a gift, by Constantine, of sovereignty to the Bishop of Rome over what were later the states of the Church and the imperial city itself. It is bound up with a story of Pope Sylvester, the contemporary of Constantine, who is represented as having baptized the emperor when he had been stricken with leprosy, as having cured the leprosy miraculously by the baptism, and as having received these new privileges and governing powers, together with a number of emblematic honors, from the gratitude of the emperor. The authenticity of that document began to be questioned in the 15th century. Arguments against it were advanced by Peacock, the eccentric but learned bishop of Chichester in England, and by Valla, the great Italian scholar in Pavia. It was badly shaken before the Reformation broke out. It became clear to the bulk of educated opinion in the 16th century that the thing was not tenable. It was full of myth, it antedated the baptism of Constantine by many years, and it was written in the spirit not of the early 4th century but rather of the 7th or even 8th. Yet it was still defended officially upon the Catholic side until quite a late date, not being finally abandoned until the 17th century. Now here was a clear case of the historic method used as a weapon against the faith, and used with apparently complete success. A false document had been accepted as true, it had even been used for supporting a definite piece of Catholic doctrine, to wit, the supremacy of the Bishop of Rome. It had been defended long after it had lost all right to be defended, it was reluctantly abandoned, and the end of the conflict looked like nothing but a humiliating defeat of ignorance at the best, and deliberate falsehood at the worst. But note what has followed in quite recent times. The donation has not been rehabilitated. For the matter of that, it never will be. But what has been proved is a most interesting example of the way in which legend and myth testify to the truth of tradition. A much more elaborate and widespread research than any of its critics had hitherto undertaken established in some points the probability, in others, the certitude, that the document first known to us in the West as the Donation of Constantine, was derived from a much earlier legend, the Acts of Saint Sylvester. It was further established that these apocryphal Acts of Saint Sylvester were, like all their kind, rooted in real history. They were formed by layers and layers of accumulated legend wrapping up a kernel of truth, as for instance, the approximate date when papal government began in the city, the gift of the Lateran Palace, the contemporary careers of Saint Sylvester and Constantine, etc. Had all record of the early 4th century been lost, these apocryphal acts would have given us half a dozen of the most important facts upon it. The process continues on all sides. It was but the other day, for instance, that a Catholic scholar 3 exploded the hitherto unquestioned academic teaching of an independent Celtic church not in communion with, nor acknowledging the supremacy of, Rome. Non-Catholic scholars have similarly re-established probable authenticity for the famous passage upon our Lord in Josephus, a scholar definitely even violently anti-Catholic for re-established on critical grounds the historicity of Saint Patrick, his mission and authorship of the Confessio. There continues, of course, a certain amount of brawling against the faith on the historical side, as in the case of the notorious Mr. Colton, but that does not belong in this section of my survey. I deal with it in its place under the popular attacks of our time. Serious history is ceasing to oppose us. The historians not of the faith remain opposed to us in philosophy, sometimes fanatically so, but the hope to damage the faith by historical research is weakening. It had a long inning. Dash.